This is Eastman's Elevated Podcast. I have on great guests that are really knowledgeable, consistently successful. We're able to dive deep down the rabbit holes of these different subject matters of shooting, of physical fitness, of mental toughness and drive. All the different skills that make up a complete hunter that you can become.
Here's your host, Brian Barney.
Hey, what's happening, guys? Got a brand new Eastman's Elevated for you. So this week on the show, I have on Paul Gibbs and Tristan Schatz. So these are two young go-getters here that are local guys that are just doing everything to become the best backcountry hunters they can. So, man, you talk about doing all the little things like the workouts, the shooting, the map research. And so we talk about that all today on the podcast, made for a great conversation. And really happy to bring it to you guys. It went well. I had these guys over. We shot bows first and then recorded a podcast. And it was just a great conversation. So we'll get right into it. I just want to thank a couple sponsors. I want to thank Kryptek. I'm so impressed by Kryptek. I have the best technical mountaineering gear system put together that I've ever had. I have a system put together all the way from the early season or hot weather hunts to the late season and cold weather hunts. And I just know I can count on this gear to keep me safe, keep me comfortable, keep me out there longer and be more efficient. I'm also really impressed by their camo patterns as I just disappear across the West. And I think it gives me a real advantage bow hunting. So I really like that Obscura transitional camo pattern. They have a couple different offerings, but that's my favorite for out West. So check that one out. And I'm just so impressed by everything that they're producing. So go check them out if you're in the market for some new gear. They have a great website over there at kryptek.com. And thanks to those guys for their support of the podcast. I also want to thank Swagger Bipods. Shooting accurately is all about your rest, and Swagger builds some of the best ones out there. They have bipods, they have shooting sticks, they have all different lengths of these, so you can get the length that fits you best. They have a quick disconnect for their Swagger Bipod, so you don't have to carry it on your rifle all the time. You can carry it in your pack and then clip it to your rifle as you get close to the moment of truth. The Swagger Bipods have adjustable legs, spring tension loaded. You can swing on the bipod, so if that elk or deer is walking left to right, you can swing to keep on that animal and make a good shot. It's great for uphill and downhill. They just make a fantastic rest, so check those guys out over at swagger.com. I also want to thank Black Ovis. Black Ovis is an internet retail shop that has absolutely everything you need for your next hunt. We have a couple different promo codes, extra 10. You can take 10% off your order there. We also have a promo code elevated10 where you also get 10% off. So you can use, I believe, either one of those codes. So you can save a pile of money on great gear. They carry all the top name brands as well as their own name brand, which is great gear. In fact, I saw Clint came out last bear season and he was wearing a lot of their clothing gear. And I was really impressed with that. My buddy Dylan has some puffy pants. I really like that. And I've also seen their sleeping bag. So go check those guys out. They're making fantastic gear, a great internet resource to be able to order everything for your next hunt. And thanks to those guys for their support. I also want to thank Black Ovis. I want to thank Camo Fire. So Camo Fire, they have 80 new hunting deals that come up every 24 hours. So you can check those guys out and download that app and save some money on some great gear there as well. Over at Eastman's, we've got the magazines. We've got the Mule Deer course. You can use promo code BrianMDC. We've got our YouTube channel, which is Eastman's Hunting TV, the Beyond the Grid show. We have a bunch of new episodes from this season, and then we'll get started on the next season here, which will be last year's hunt. So really excited to see those come out. Really stoked at that goat film, how that thing came out from this season. So go check us out there. Check out the other podcasts we have, the Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal, Life of a Bow Hunter, the one I do with Dan Picard. It's a great podcast, and so that's bi-weekly. You have to check it out on a different feed, but check us out there as well. And with that, just getting this podcast out to you guys and getting to work. We had my my computer and my camera die in the same day, so I'm making do on my backup computer here, but we'll get everything edited and out to you guys, and hopefully I'll get those electronics here back soon. So yeah, I can't believe same day. I've had that computer for probably 10 years. It's you know, it's a great computer. It has been. But yeah, all of a sudden stopped working. And also my good camera that I do a bunch of filming and photography. I went fishing with Dylan Ness. We took the wall tent and went and chased big browns there for a few days, which was really fun. And he caught a great fish. And so I went to give him the photos at the end and I couldn't get to my review button. And so anyways, my camera's on the fritz too, which I was looking to upgrade for this season. So it'll all work out and we just deal with it as it comes. But it is crazy to have both things go out at the same time. But I won't bore you with my electronic saga here at trying to get these things done. Let's get into this podcast. It's a great one. Two young go-getters that are absolutely doing it, and it made for a great conversation. So Tristan Schatz, Paul Gibbs, I'm your host, Brian Barney, Eastman's Elevated. Here we go. So yeah, what I want to talk about today is just get you guys on here and like the younger up-and-coming generation like you guys that are just hustling, man. It's like, and I'll talk about it on the podcast. Well, like we can just get into it. So like I'm just so impressed by you guys, by the success that you've had in a short amount of time. And I really think it's like your dedication to the craft. Like we saw today, we just got done shooting bows and you guys shoot phenomenal, like better than grown men that have been shooting their whole lives. So not that you guys aren't grown men.
But, well, I'm getting there. I'm going to try.
What is your guys' age? How old are you?
22.
I'm 23.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man. So you guys are like really wise beyond your years and you're just getting the most out of the outdoors. So Tristan, you just moved back to Montana.
I did. Yeah. Yep. Made the big move back. Mm-hmm. I was gone for about a year, but I couldn't not come back. I told you I'd be back. And
it was funny. It, I was texting him and calling him about every week. I was like, so this is what I'm doing. What are you doing? He's like, absolutely nothing. Yeah. I was giving him a hard time about every week just to stay in his ear and make sure he was going to get back here.
Yeah, a lot of work in Colorado and did a lot of trim stuff. So it helps coming back here, rolling into trim stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, happy to be back.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we're happy to have you back. And just like happy to have you back here in the community too. I was just so proud of what you guys accomplished. And Colorado has some great opportunity there. And you've killed animals there and hunted with your family. But Montana's pretty special, right? There's a lot of opportunity in the long seasons. It gives you so much experience in the woods that I think like you're able to learn so much in a short order out here, like hunting. Don't you think, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, geez, you think about it in terms of I'll start in the summertime. I mean, you get a basically over-the-counter antelope tag. You start hunting antelope mid-August. You roll over beginning of September, you're already hunting elk. Then next thing you know, it's mule deer and you're rolling into January. If you can pick up a tag down south for over the counter deer somewhere else, you're hunting all the way through January. And then, I mean, you could hunt wolves and lions off season, which I know you did that this year.
Yeah. And but, you're hunting sheds now, right?
Yeah. I mean, you've got 1 month off maybe, which we sit there in the gym, we're training hard in the gym. And then next thing you know, it's shed season, spring bear season. Spring bear goes until June 15th here, Montana and Idaho. Mm-hmm. So then you're back around to July again. It's like, well, I got to get ready for the fall again.
So true, man. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, for a guy that loves the outdoors, it's like a great place to be, you know, and you guys have made the most of it as well. Like that experience is so key and so clutch, like in the learning process. It's like there's so many, it's the information day and age and there's so much stuff out there, but you have to apply it to your own knowledge and your own hunting. And so that's exactly what you guys do. Like when it's hunting season, that's all you guys are doing is all in these different spots. Like Paul, I saw you traveling for mule deer this year. Oh, killed a great mule deer buck in some place you'd never been.
Yeah, actually it was a spot I'd been but never harvested a buck in, but it was only my second time in there. And yeah, packed up camp, went in a good long ways into some nasty backcountry, and first night of being in there, had a great buck pushing a bunch of does up in beginning of November, and made it happen on him. And I mean, yeah, just the traveling you get to do, and the state's so big. Mm-hmm. It's so much opportunity, and I just fortunate to be here. That's mm-hmm. just how I feel.
Well, you guys are in the trades too, which I think is like a good way to go to be able to get free time. Like you have to work hard and you have to, you know, build a life for yourself, but then you also want to get that time in the mountains, whether it's like even just a Friday on the weekend or to have a week to go hunt, or, you know, like in your guys' case, like living in a great place, it's like even a free evening. Like I called Tristan on Friday to pick up a sink and he's like, oh, I'm going for a hike, you know, and you're already in the mountains. Like that's key to learning, I think, is just putting yourself out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so.
I mean, going through September, antelope season, obviously, every night after work. I'm fortunate to live right here. And after work, I go hunting locally. I hunt elk locally. I hunt deer. So I'm hunting just about every night after work. Or if it's looking like it's going to shape up to be a good morning, or I was into them last night, I'll even go in a little bit late to work and work later that next day. And it's just crazy being able to tailor the days to hunt mornings or afternoons and fit work in and still getting full days. I mean, you get pretty tired, you know, that time of year. It's exhausting, but just getting to hunt that 40, 50 days this season in the fall is, I feel like that's why I have been able to develop very fast at such a young age, is because of that opportunity.
Yeah, well, and also your guys' commitment to the craft. It's like, you know, shooting tonight, it's a perfect example. The commitment to your bows. You guys are will use all weapons, so you'll hunt rifle seasons, which give you more time in the woods, more time for experience. You just mentioned the gym, so you guys are constantly working out. Like Tristan's like the one guy who's in really good shape on the job site. When it's anything heavy, it's like mine and Tristan's job, right? Like we leave the old guys, I'm like, oh, me and Tristan got it, moving in a stove or whatever. It's great, but keeping yourself in good shape, like doing all these little things make you a better outdoorsman as well, like believing in the process. Don't you think, Tristan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think, as far as working on your own equipment as well, like this, when I did move back to Colorado for a year, the first couple months I was there, I actually worked at a pro shop, and that opened my eyes to what archery really is and how to tune your own bow. So bringing that over here, getting here and setting up, I think we've set up like 6 bows in the last 2 months.
I think it was more than that. I think it was 10.
Yeah, it was a lot of bows. So
backups just for us, mains, and then girlfriends. We set up our girlfriends really sweet bows, and they've been loving getting into it too. And then I've got a younger brother who's really into it, so I've been working and tuning his bow, and he just sold his and got a different one, so we just set up 2 for him. And it's just getting to tinker with that much equipment, especially with the archery side, and getting to really understand all the intricacies to it.
Yeah, it goes a long way. I mean, just as far as like setting up your own rifles, throwing your own scopes, your pick rails on your rifles, you learn the ins and outs of everything. Then when you go shoot and you apply it, you know what's wrong when something does go wrong. So my eyes were kind of closed to that before, whereas within this last year, it's opened up a lot. And I feel like it's helped me quite a bit, and I can see me gaining progress even more so and more quickly now because of that. But yeah, it's fun tinkering with your own stuff and using your press here for, I don't even know, I probably texted you like 10 times to use your press.
You don't even have to text me. You can just come over and use it anytime. Yeah. But no, you're so spot on, like that, the inner workings of everything. And not only that, but like, you know, as we talk about the details, like we're talking to, like if we were talking to young men out there that wanted to see consistent success or start to see this progression in the outdoors, this is what it takes. It's this commitment to it, the commitment of learning the ins and outs of the bows and the rifle and then the gear as well. You know, you guys are always looking for the very best gear that's going to perform the best in the mountains. You guys work in the trades, you can save your money and then purchase that gear. So now you guys are all set up. You have everything you need. It doesn't cost that much once you're set up.
Yeah. And it's one piece at a time. Yeah. It doesn't need to be everything jumped in immediately. Like that's what we've done, is we've just slowly built and built and built. And you know, every paycheck we put a little bit aside and we just get the next little nice piece and the next nice piece. And eventually you're like, dang, I've got all this sweet stuff. This is awesome. Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know how I got here.
Yeah. Well, and then you can progress that hunting into a backpack style of hunting and get comfortable with the mountains and sleeping in there. And so it's like, doing those upgrades. I like to think of it like, you know, what's, what's the biggest upgrade I need to make right now of my gear? If I look over all my gear, where can I save weight? Where can I save space? Where do I need more performance? And then attack that piece of gear. And I always think it's like, we hear it all the time, but it's like cry once, pay once, you know? It's like, you know, pick out the best piece of gear, at least a good piece of gear that's going to perform really well for you if you're going to spend your money, so you don't have to keep upgrading.
Yeah. And right now for me, that is my sleeping bag. I really want to upgrade and get one of those 30-degree quilts. Mm-hmm. I think that's just such a cool piece of equipment to really cut out a lot of weight and a lot of bulk. That's the problem with a bag for me, is it's so much space inside of my pack. And I like running a really small pack, even if I'm backpacking. Like, I think it's the Solo 3800 from Stone Glacier is what I use. Mm-hmm. And I think being able to size down with that quilt and be a lot more compact is going to be a nice addition. So yep, that's one thing that I am saving up for that I got to get before this coming bear season. But that was just an example that I was thinking of one of those things that on the big spectrum of all of my gear, mm-hmm, I'm like, man, that would be really nice. And that'd be a great upgrade to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got one sitting behind you. You have to check it out. It's that one in the middle right there. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. That one there. Yeah. They're sweet, man, and definitely paired with like your puffy gear, you can ride out even colder nights. I think you can add 10 degrees to it, you know, like wearing your puffy gear to bed or whatever.
Yeah, it's so, like, I always have that with me.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good piece of gear. It's nice when you can start to specialize, when it's like, because at first you buy one piece of gear that'll do everything. Well, then pretty soon that 0-degree bag is pretty heavy and bulky, mm-hmm, to be packing around the mountains when it's only getting to 30 or 40 at night, you know?
Yeah, so, and you're sleeping outside of it next thing you know. It's like, why did I even bring this?
Yeah, totally, yeah, man. Totally. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you just upgrade it as you can, and eventually you have like a pretty good kit you have confidence in.
Yeah, I think it goes a long way to be in depth with gear too. And I think the way I think both of us have done it, Paul and I both, I know myself, but I mean, buying those cheap pieces, because I mean, we're 22 and 23, so we're just now making decent money. So when you are making X amount of dollars and can afford X gear, you're not usually buying the best gear. And then, mm-hmm, when you do eventually make that upgrade, you really appreciate the good gear. Oh, I've been through my fair share of bad sleeping bags, bad tents, cheap tents.
Horrible backpacks. Yeah, oh, God.
The more good you gear learn you buy. It the hard way, too, don't you? It's never the easy way. It's always painful, like getting drenched in a tent or not being warm enough, you know, a night's sleep or whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, and sometimes, you know, like, I think toughness can override your gear, like, in a lot of ways. So it's great to be all set up. It's great to have your gear system. But ultimately, when you're hunting in the mountains, it doesn't matter what piece of gear you, like, you still have to have this never quit, always go for it attitude. And that toughness can almost trump, you know, like bad gear or whatever. Like, you can have a sleeping bag, but if you're just tough in the mountains and you're able to make it through it, like, you know, yes, you have to keep dry, you have to keep warm. There's some essentials to keeping safe and keeping comfortable, but I don't know, toughness and grit. Like, you know, as we sit here and talk about the key to success, like, I really, like, would put that on a pedestal, at least for me, is just this persistence and just this drive and this grit and this toughness and this ability to endure tough conditions. And I would venture to bet that your guys' success would be the exact same.
Yeah.
Am I right?
If you, like, I'm losing my words here.
Yeah. I think for me personally, like, a lot of people say it, but you have those harsh packouts, those harsh hunts, and the harder it gets, the more I like it. You might not like it in the moment, but when you're done with it and you get to tell a story afterwards, that's when, I mean, I really appreciate it. The good stories come out, people hear it, they want to go do it. Some people do and some people don't, but yeah.
It's like that bear from last year. I'm sure I told you that story probably 10 times now.
Yeah.
But it was one of the most terrifying packouts of my life. Just horrible situation. And earlier that year, I'm big into skiing. I really tore up my ankle bad. Tore ligaments on both sides and the top of my foot in March. And come May 4th, I found a really big bear in some pretty gnarly backcountry, about 6 miles in. And after work, made a rip in there. He was there. Crossed a big canyon, 1,000 foot down, 1,000 foot up, and got on him. But the pack out is through just thick alders, grizzly kill in the area, fresh grizzly sign in the area. I'm solo, I'm out of water, don't really have much food because I just left straight from work with my backpack and a rifle to go try to kill this bear that I saw the day before. And I mean, it was knee deep snow through this bottom and I'm just trying to get out of here. And like, just, I was praying, but I look back on that and I didn't get back to the truck until 4 a.m. And I'm like, man, that was the sickest hunt. That was awesome. And to come out with a big, just 6 foot five bear, one of my best bears. And it's exactly what you just said. It was that grit, that horrible part of it. And it had nothing to do with the gear that I had, really. It would have been just as miserable with anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just the most incredible experience. And especially looking back on it a year later, now I'm even more excited for this spring bear. And I'm like, well, at least I got a friend to go do it with.
Yeah.
It's a type two fun, you know? Yeah. Tristan helped me pack out my moose as well. Came in that day and helped me pack it out. But you're right. I think that's when you really grow as an outdoorsman or grow as a human as well. Like all these skills and traits that you learn in the mountains, like, You gain toughness that night. I mean, you gain toughness by enduring and doing those things. And in the moment, like, being brave is not never being scared. Being brave is being scared and doing it anyways. And on a lot of these big hunts, on a lot of these big goes, on a lot of these big sends, like, they're scary for me too. It's like, you know, I got to drive away from my family and I'm going in the most rugged, extreme country I can go find and disappearing with everything in my pack, hoping I can survive for 10 days. And throughout the years, you build a confidence and then you build like this wood sense and you've been in these scenarios. And so like you get comfortable with it and you're able to make it through. But I really think like those tough times, that type two fun, it's like not fun all the time. Like in the moment, I don't think you were having the most fun when you thought there was a grizzly bear around every corner in your middle of the night packing that thing out. But you get out and that's all you can think about is getting back because it's an adventurous lifestyle. And it's like you can't get that adventure anywhere else in life, at least for us guys that enjoy what we love to do, you know?
Absolutely. And something you just said that I don't ever hear people talk about is the fear part of it. There is a lot of fear, especially like I started solo hunting when I was 18. That's when I started solo backpacking and solo hunting because I didn't really know anybody around and I just did it. And it's scary. It still is scary to drive across the state of Montana, which I don't do a ton of out-of-state tags. I do a few, but I just use Montana as an example because that's primarily where I hunt. I'm going out to these gnarly areas where I don't know. I'm going alone. I'm doing all these things. And the mountains around here, you got grizzly bears, wolves, lions, all of it. There's a lot of fear involved with it. And that's the biggest barrier for me. That mental toughness is overcoming the fear of it. It's not even just enduring how tough it is. There's so much fear in it as well that 100%. I have to overcome personally. And that's something that I don't ever hear talked about really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%, man. I know I have it. Yeah, for sure. It's like you get in those sketchy situations, you know, and really push your limits, you know, and you got to keep your wits about you. And you try not to get overwhelmed by the moment and you try to just keep dissecting it. What's my next move? What's the smart play? Because the decisions you make directly affect your safety and, you know, directly affect your success. And so you have to make good decisions in the moment. But I think it's important to not get overwhelmed. But yeah, that fear is real, man. It's like, I think that's what living an adventurous life is. And if I think everybody has it. I know I do. And like listening to you talk about it, I know you do, but it's overcoming that. And then the growth from it, you know, I think that's amazing. And I think if you're not scaring yourself a bit, you're not pushing hard enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the more scary things you do in that sense, the more you grow and the scarier things you do, the more you grow from that. Not saying the things you do shouldn't be scary, but then you do a thing, you go on a hunt that might be next level and you're more so scared of other things happening or more scared on that hunt than the last hunt, but you know you can do it because you went through it on the last hunt and it just helps you grow in every way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the unknown. I mean, the one, like my biggest fear in the mountains, like well, there's a lot of them that can get you, but the one that really gets me that I hate calling it like PTSD because I don't want to compare myself to military. But the truth is it's like a human condition that you can get. And so mine's lightning, like hunting those early high country muleys. Like lightning just hits different on those peaks, especially when you're above 10 or above 12,000. And when I was young, I used to push really hard and watching weather reports, and you sleep on these ridge lines that are fairly exposed, and you're like, well, I don't think it's coming in tonight, not the report. And then all of a sudden, like I had one in a mountain range here in Montana, well, in the Missions in there, where I'd looked at the forecast, it was good, and I tried to sleep on top, and I had some bucks over the top that I was going to hunt. And that storm came in on me that night, and I had like a lightning plan where I got out of my tent, off the ridge line, down and into the trees, and then it just dumped on, it just poured. And like you say, you're by yourself, and lightning's just flickering and flashing everywhere. And when you have that lightning that's inside a half a mile, where you see the light and it's shocking and you hear the boom at the same time and it's so loud and thunderous and you feel it from the ground up your body, dude. And it's just petrifying to me, like that stuff. So I'm really safe around lightning. But even before my hunts, I know that I'm going to run into big storms and I'm going to run into lightning and I'm going to be better for overcoming it. So I almost try to like jump that hurdle in my head before I go. Like, okay, this is how I'm going to handle it. I know there's going to be storms. And I've had hunts where it's every single afternoon the big storms roll in. And I'm living out of a tent in there where I've had 300 strikes within a half mile where I'm just scared to death in my tent and think I'm going to get struck. So that's like real fear for me that I have to overcome still to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been in a couple of those. I don't know if they've been as extreme as yours, but where you can feel the thunder in the, like laying in my tent, you can feel the thunder coming through the ground. It'll scare you. But I think for me too, I mean, I came out to Montana not ever seeing a grizzly bear. Mm-hmm. And then I told myself that I wanted to see one, and my wish came true. Saw one a little closer than I wanted. But yeah, I think my first year out here, I ended up seeing more grizzlies than I did black bears.
Yeah.
So I think they go hand in hand, but yeah, I'm not too much of a fan of G-bears. they scare me.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, man, they're terrifying. You know, there's monsters out there. Like, you don't need a Sasquatch. There's like real grizzly out there, and our mountain grizzlies are really ornery, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's attacks every year. So it's real, you know, but you just have to, like, you have to continue to go. And what those grizzly bears or any of this fear, it can get inside your head and ruin your hunt and control you and stop you from going hard. And that's just like human nature and safety of trying to keep yourself safe. But I know those grizzly bears, they get inside your head where you're walking around the mountains and you think there's one around every tree, every time you sleep, every sound you hear. But eventually you start to get comfortable with it, right? It's like you keep your head on a swivel. It's like, okay, I know what I'm going to do when I see a bear. I practice drawing my pistol. I practice aiming my pistol. Like, I'm good in that situation, shooting it. I know I'm accurate. I'm going to keep my head on a swivel. I'm going to avoid bears. So if I see them in an area, I'm not going to go in the middle of them over there. I'm going to give them a wide berth. Okay, I'm going to camp in the thick trees to where they roll ridge lines and meadows at night. Like, they have no reason to come in the thick trees. And then I'll even block trails with sticks and things. So at least if they're coming in, I can hear them coming through the sticks and logs and kind of make natural barricades, get in the thick timber. And then, yeah, and then you just realize how many people are out in the mountains, like, every year, all year, like hunting with bows and rifles and recreating. And there are a couple attacks in our valley every year. And the ones you have to watch out for are the sows with cubs, and you got to watch out for grizzly bears protecting a carcass. So it's like, you know those two things. So it's like, you pay attention to those. But once you start to get your sense around those bears, and the more you hunt black bears, the more you're around grizzly bears, the more comfortable you get with them too. You realize that they're not out just hunting you. Mm-hmm. You realize that you run into 10 grizzly bears and 9 of them are going to run away from you. You might get one ornery one, and that one might not even charge. It might just stand up or bluff or whatever the case is.
Yeah.
So you kind of just build these processes, I think, to deal with that fear, deer. And it's real fear. Grizzly bears are real, and we see them out here all the time. So you have to be ready for it.
That's what I really wanted to circle back to and say is, every fear instance that you've said, the things that it seems like help you is that preparation and thought process going into it, where you are prepared and you already have a mental process of what you're going to do. And it seems like that's how you deal with that fear. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. I haven't ever nailed it down like that, like you just did, but I think you're right. That is how we deal with it.
Hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And it can't keep you from doing what you love. You still got to go do it.
No, that's not keeping me out of the mountains. I mean, it has a time or two. Fear has definitely been a factor of ruining a hunt for me. But
I think, yeah, I think it has with everyone, but some people keep doing it. And that's, yeah, why you're successful.
Yeah, I'm pretty hard-headed, so I'll take a little more than you, I guess, to ruin my hunts.
Well, and two, you know, you have to be sensible. You do have to, like, make quality decisions where you're, you know, if somebody just got attacked up some drainage, I'm not the first one to go jump into that drainage. It's like, oh, I think I'll hunt somewhere else, you know. But, yeah, I mean, even hunting this year here for bulls, or every year here for bulls, but doing a lot of night walking. And so, you know, you just got to make sure that you've got a nice bright headlamp that can see eyes. And you got to be ready with your pistol. I put some, I'll have to show you guys my sight I put on there, but it's got like, they're like glow in the dark side, or then
the iridium.
Yeah,
that stuff's awesome.
So what is that, man?
It's some sort of, I don't even know what kind of
material. Because it stays illuminated, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's radioactive or what. It seems like it.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I was asking because you're an electrician by trade, so you like know a lot of those things. But
I think I need to be more of a chemist.
Totally. It's not a fiber optics. It's like constantly illuminated on your sight, and it doesn't burn out for like 20 years or something like
it's
that.
Wild,
I think.
Yeah.
No battery, no nothing.
Huh.
It's a pretty sweet sight for night. You pull up on it good, and then a headlamp. Yeah. At times, I've ran a light on my pistol that I can flick, but they don't make a holster that has that light, or at least I haven't found the one.
One thing that I've started doing is I keep it in my backpack. I carry it. I think it's a 2300 lumen stream light.
Good
and then it's got a big pocket clip. So I'll clip that right on my vinyl harness right here on my left side. So I've got my pistol draw on my right and that draw on my left, because if I'm only running a headlamp, my problem is I get so much glare off the back of my handgun and off the sights that I can barely see the target. So when I do that, I can use this arm, I mean, like a lot of tactical guys do, and rest up with that pistol with the right hand over my left and get a big illumination with that bigger light. And I'd have to imagine a 2300 lumens in the dark in something's eyes would really disorient it too and give even more time.
100%.
So that's something that I started running last year that actually gave me a lot of confidence as well.
I bet. Yeah, that's smart. A big light is nice, isn't it? You just see what's out there looking in the dark, dude, because it's spooky when you're sleeping out there in the middle of the wilderness in the dark, you know, especially by yourself or something like that. So, yeah, you definitely want to have those processes built in, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yep. Well, you guys will have to get ready for it. Yeah, horn season, bear season, and then elk and mule deer. And you guys are stoked, and you guys have an out-of-state tag this year, traveling for mule deer, new range that you guys haven't hunted, right?
Correct.
Or you spent a little time in there, Paul.
I have for elk. I have not hunted deer in there, but I did see a lot of deer that made me really excited. Now it's just seeing big herds of does, and it was only late September, so it's going to be very different from the time frame we're going to be hunting. I mean, they change so much from month to month to season to season, so... Mm-hmm. It'll be a little bit of a learning curve, but I do at least have a little bit of familiarity with the range.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an awesome hunt. We're excited for it.
That one came from there.
Really?
Yeah. They have really good genetics in there, man. They grow them big and heavy. All those deer grow on me when I walk up to them. And that deer, it's like, he doesn't score the best, but he's a really good late season buck for me. I was just absolutely stoked with him. And you can see the mass on the bladed tongue. And it's tough. He's sitting next to a velvet, which velvets are always about 40% heavier. But he doesn't have the biggest tines or anything, but just a great buck.
No, he carries that mass all the way through. And those eye guards are gnarly, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a great one, man. Super stoked with him. So, yeah, you guys will have fun.
Yeah.
It's like part of this process is being able to learn locations as well. So, like, you know, year after year, you start to build this working knowledge of areas. And so this is where it's like the best training grounds in the world. Like, this was my training grounds to build my hunting skill set. This has been your guys' training grounds to build your guys' hunting skill set. We get so much opportunity from antelope to bear to elk to deer to whatever the case is. And so, it's really difficult to learn areas. And, like, these mountain ranges, there isn't animals, like, spread out all over through it. They're, like, in pockets of country. And so you have to be good at, like, being able to identify these pockets of country. But I'm so impressed, you know, by both of you guys. But Tristan, like, only being here a year, you just started exploring. You started finding accesses, and you didn't have any previous knowledge. Like, you know, sometimes you go, hey, yeah, I'm headed up in this area. And I'd go, oh, yeah, up in there. It's like there's this and there's this and there's that. But you did it all yourself. And, of course, with your buddy Paul. And, Paul, you've done the same way. You've just taught yourself this area. And the wild thing is, like, you guys have different areas than I have in the valley. Like, you guys just have different spots that you found and found critters. So, like, finding these areas, like, what do you think the key is to it? Do you think it's just exploring, getting out there, spending time in areas, striking out? Like, how have you guys been able to find, like, good locations and good critters, like, so fast?
Well, for me, it was taking every opportunity to be outside possible and paying attention. When I moved here, I didn't have residency my first season, and I couldn't afford to apply for an out-of-state elk tag. I didn't have enough money. So what I did is I picked up over-the-counter cow tag that was left over, and it was still $300, but I got all the experience of elk hunting. I got to start learning, and I found a bunch of mule deer, actually, when I was doing that. Come next year, I killed a great 160-inch mule deer with a drop tine because I had saw him the year before just cow hunting, whitetail tags. I was out running the mountains, and there's not many whitetails in the mountains, but there are some enough for me to go hunt them, and I got to learn all of these different areas. And I just like to compile all these points. I mean, my Onyx looks ridiculous because it's just these mountains of waypoints that look ridiculous, and there's no organization to it. But just then compiling all of that and starting to learn, oh, this is what these do here, and this is what they do here in this time of year and that time of year. And it all just starts building on itself, and it was just time outside. It's time paying attention. And not just walking around, but pick up your binos, look at that hillside, really pay attention to what's around you and what they're doing. It all starts coming together. What about you, Tristan?
Yeah, I mean, coming from Colorado and growing up with my dad got back into hunting because I wanted to go hunting with him. So doing that, I mean, it was like I've heard you say, a school of hard knocks. Like, we're just tromping around the woods. And I mean, you'd find critters and you'd do things differently the next hunt, and you might find more critters or you might find less. And I think doing that time and time again, I started to, comprehend where these animals were living, whether it was a high country mule deer, elk, everything in Colorado that I could hunt. And then I just applied that here. But I think, Paul's better at it than I am as far as e-scouting. He's got pins up the wazoo. I don't have very many pins, but I just go where I think I would. I look at it on the maps and everything and look at the terrain features and everything else, but I think you can't beat boots on the ground and just exploring the country. You'll see stuff that you'll never see on the maps, and I don't think you can have a bad day out in the woods anyway tromping around.
And the reason my Onyx looks like that is because I would see something. I'd see a set of tracks or a game trail that was really worn in, and I'd mark it. But then after you go hunting and you see these animals in these areas, I'd be able to get on the maps and say even sheds. I'd be like, oh, this is the sort of feature I'm looking for. And I could cross-reference that to 10 others just from two that I had found before. And that is just like the biggest e-scouting tip for me, at least, was being able to cross-reference from what I've seen in person a couple times that seemed like a pattern and pushing that across a bigger spectrum and then getting to test that theory. And if it works out, it's crazy because then it opens up all of that country that you can now find with that one little key that you found.
Yeah. So smart, you guys.
He's good at that.
That's exactly
Paul's,
right.
Paul's extremely detailed.
So you got to get into labeling your waypoints, and then now every year you got to go new color. So you can see the new color on there. But I'm the same way. It's like you don't get organized until you have a chaos of just pins everywhere. It's like, I can't even remember what that went to, you know? It's like an elk picture here. Like, what in the heck did I? But that's really smart. So I like what you said, Tristan, of boots to ground. Like, nothing replaces boots to ground and walking in an area and, like, really learning it. And like, not only picking up and glassing different features, but picking up on the sign that you see, the track. The when they're using that, to think about that. And then Paul, that e-scouting, like that piece of e-scouting that you figured out, like having an eye for it. People always ask me, like, what are you looking for bucks? Is it feed? Is it a cover? Is it water? And it's like, well, it's all those things, but you start to get a feel for what bucky terrain looks like. Mm-hmm. And like you say, in one area, like, it can be different. People's like, well, do I look on the south slope? Do I look on the north slope? And it's like, well, okay, in our country, like, you know, a lot of the animals like the cover of the north slopes, and this is just a totally general, you know, rule.
Oh, yeah.
So our north slopes, like especially like hunting bears, our north slopes are money, where our south slopes are too open and they don't go there, you know, and it's like it burns off quick to where the north side stay lush and shaded and green. But then you go to western Montana and the south slopes are good there because the north slopes are just so much timber that no light ever gets through and there's no foliage or openings, but the south side has more timber, so it has sparse openings. So there's never like a one direction to look because it's different in all places. But when you can start to e-scout and, like you said, Paul, like find one area and start to find this pattern, two areas, and these produce, now you can start to transpose that information that you found into your e-scouting to look for areas within that unit or within that area that look like that. And then you walk in there and it's like, oh, there's animals there. Mm-hmm. Like it's finding that pattern to e-scouting, finding what looks like where you see critters. It's no mistake that critters are there. And so you can look for other places that are similar to that. So it's like you guys are so spot on. Like that's why you guys have learned good hunting areas, because you're doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's places that you'll see too that you see it from a mountain range over, or you're looking at a mountain range and you just look at each other and you're like, that looks like an elky spot. Let's go.
Yeah.
And sure enough, there's elk in there. Like when you know, you know. I'm sure there's 100% of the time there's not elk in every drainage that you think looks elky, but
about that camp we had up on the top of that mountain up at 10,000 some feet, and we're up there about every weekend just glassing these different basins trying to find some high country elk because we really wanted to hunt elk way up high. And we're glassing and there's this basin like 4 miles away that looks really good.
Yeah.
And Tristan's just like adamant behind the spotters. She's like, there's got to be elk over there. And sure enough, he picks out a stud of a 6-point bull over there. And then come a week before season, that bull's there with cows. And then we find some nice muley bucks in that same basin, just all from that one vantage, because he was looking across that, just like he was saying, and just knew that there was something there. It just looked like that elky bucky terrain.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had a good a good goof on that one. I ran after some bucks trying to go up over the ridge and look at him and ended up blowing up my foot.
Oh, no. Yeah.
That was when I was limping around the job site for a week.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Okay, yeah. So that happened like hustling over the ridge to get a peek at him or something?
Yeah, we caught like a quick glance of some bucks running up over the ridge. And we both know pretty well that Montana's pretty hard for high country mule deer, but we're also adamant about trying to find some good bucks up there. And we just saw antlers going up over the ridge, so I was like, oh, let's go. And we took off, and Paul was smarter than I was, took a little slower, and I went a little faster.
I think we were just at the same pace, and I think I just managed to take a right step and maybe took a left.
Yeah, it was rough, but long story short, yeah, it looked good, and sure enough, there was critters there. Just had to look hard enough and long enough.
Mm-hmm. And being willing to go there, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's a lot of this hunting, too, is like, it's not always going to work out. You're not going to find critters in every drainage, but that looking over the next hill, that giving that full effort. And like you can be on a hunt. Like I was on a hunt with a cameraman this year for bulls. And we went on this hunt. I had this hunt plan. We started early in the dark. We got to where I wanted. You know, lights are coming on. And this is when you should just hear them sounding off and see them on the openings. And they're in the parks. And this is perfect timing. I'm in the spot. It's just like nothing. It's just crickets. No bugles, no elk. I can't glass any up. But I just know that if I continue to put forth effort, I'm going to turn up a bull. Maybe not today. Maybe it's tomorrow. Maybe it's a week from now. But I know eventually I'll kill one. So I just kept hunting us up the ridge and kept hunting us. It's later morning. Now it's like 9 o'clock. Now it's like they're starting to get put away. You're starting to get to the end of your morning hunt. But it's like, oh, just this one more vantage point, and then we can sit there for a bit and look around. Just the last place we get at 9:30, 9:15, they're just putting away, and we catch a herd a couple miles over, you know, and a great big 6-point bull. And then ended up hunting that bull for a couple days in a new area and just found him. But my cameraman said he's like, I would have turned around at the base of that hill. He's like, there's no way I would have kept going up there. I thought you were nuts. You know, he hadn't seen, hadn't heard anything. But it's that continual effort of looking over the next ridge or seeing a drainage 4 miles off and doing whatever it takes to get back there, that there still is an effort element to it. And there's a lot of guys in good shape and a lot of guys going hard, but it's like getting the total package of like willing to put forth effort, toughness and grit, knowledge, e-scouting. It's like all these different facets, all these different skills that it takes to be successful. And that's like the beauty of like backcountry hunting that we found, is that it is so difficult. And so it like just drives you to keep improving and getting better.
So mm-hmm. one thing I want to ask you that I'm still trying to understand myself and get a feel for is, I've got some spots that have always produced for me, always have a bunch of elk. When you go in there and it is those crickets, is there times that you want to stay in there and then just wait glass and continue to give it an opportunity? Because obviously elk are always moving. Do you ever just stay on one of those areas or glass the same basin for elk? Or do you continue through until you find them? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, how do you judge that, or how do you go about that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. It's like feel and instincts, and like you're trying to gauge it. But, you know, I don't do very good waiting for animals to show up. I never have. It's like I know they like that drainage and I know they'll be there. So I have a drainage that's just money. That's what you're talking about. That's the bulls show up there. It's an absolute party. And I've had it all to myself at times where it's just there's 10, 12 different bulls. And I know every year there's a bunch of elk that live in this place. And there's, you can hunt the back end, you can hunt the way back, you can hunt this side basin that goes way up into the rocks. Then you get down, you can hunt like some logging country and up to the ridge line. Then you can hunt the lowlands. There's like 5 or 6 different hunts in this drainage, right? And so I go up there, but people have started to figure out this drainage because it's easy access. And so there'll be guys in there and they'll chase those elk around. So I know this is a money spot. So throughout elk season, I'll just go heat check it. It's like I go in there and I go see if they're there. And if they're not there, I like don't get discouraged or disappointed. I know they're going to show up, but I'll just go to a different place and keep hunting. Now I'll go heat check it 2 days from now, 3 days from now. I'll see when they show up, but I don't do good like just sitting in a drainage waiting for them to show up and come to me. I'm sure that can work for some people, but that's kind of how I go about it, is I got to go find them, you know, as like, so an elk talk and they, you see them. And so I'm trying to spend the time morning and night in those locations, trying to locate them. So, I mean, there is a time where it's like, okay, I didn't locate an elk, but you know, I really couldn't listen or couldn't see that up there. Like, maybe I need to check that out tonight, or maybe I need to give it another day because this is such a good drainage that there's probably elk around in here, and really give it my all to where if I'm in a new spot and I got to a prime time vantage and I didn't see any elk in there, well, now it's like I just got to go look somewhere else. And see, these elk, they're like they're real nomadic. They have like 20 miles of range of feeding features and bedding features and drainages they like. And you can go up the best elk drainage in the world and there isn't elk there all the time. It's timing. They're in there the third week of September, and that can shift a few days. But once you find timing in these spots, like, oh, when the weather hits, they show up here. Or during the first part of the rut, when all of the elk get together and they sort it out and they take their groups, happens around the 5th or the 7th, and this place is good for that. And oh, after they spread out, I always find them over in this drainage. It's not going to be every time, but it's like a pretty good chance. And so you start to get the timing of where these elk are and when they're there, and then start to recognize when they're there, and then like heat check those spots that are okay. Good. That's how I go about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And another follow-up question to that is, so let's say one of your drainages isn't producing, do you continue hiking through and push up to the next basin or next drainage and check that? Or are you relocating, say, another 10 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, hitting another range completely? What are you doing if your heat check isn't, let's say, checking out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's like different for every spot. But if I have a good elk drainage, yeah, I mean, there's times where I'm committed to 2-3 days. And so I'm just going to move my camp and hunt with my camp on my back and just go get to a new area. It's like, okay, so I went up this drainage and I got my best vantage points. They're not here. I don't hear them bugling. I don't see them. Okay, I'm confident because I spent one vantage point in here or 2 vantage points and I covered this drainage. They're not here. So I've got to move. So I'm either going to move with my camp and with my tent, and I'm going to go relocate another ridge over, another 2 miles where I couldn't see, where I couldn't hear. Now I'm going to check out that spot. If I don't find them there, then I'm going to move. And I'll just keep bouncing mornings and evenings through wilderness spots like that, checking it. Now, if I'm, you know, someplace that's roaded or more access, then I'm going to go up that drainage and I'm going to go check it. And you know, I have some backpack spots too where I'll go for an overnighter, or I'll take my sleeping bag and my pad with me, and it's like, okay, I'll go in here tonight. If I get into them, I'll stay. If I don't get into them, maybe I'll push back. But a lot of times where there's access, I'm going to go hit a drainage. If I don't find them, I'm like hitting a new spot for the next morning or evening. And if I know that's a good drainage, I may hunt two or three hunts over here, and then I'll bounce back and I'll check it again.
Absolutely. And another question to that just came up when you were saying that, but that all definitely makes good sense. What are you doing midday? I know there's a lot of guys that are like, oh, midday is the best. Midday is the best. I have the slowest, worst action for elk midday personally. Yeah. And I've called a lot of elk, but I prefer to spot and stalk just like you. What are you doing midday? Are you just using that to travel and hike in? Are you just staying in that country on that vantage? What are you doing midday during these hunts? Because I hear you say morning and evenings a lot.
Yeah, nothing. I'm doing what the elk are doing. I'm sleeping. I've been on so many bulls and chased them in. And every once in a while, you find a bull that's really heated up in the middle of the day. But just with all those cows bedded in there and that bull in there, my best chance is like when I, you know, to spot and stalk them. Right in the morning, they're going to feed a little bit. You usually don't have a chance to get on them in that feed ground because there isn't enough time. So then they're on the move and they're moving to bedding, and I'll try to shadow that herd to bedding. And if I can keep moving with them, right before they bed, they mill around and feed. So if you can kind of follow them into that stuff, keep your eyes, see them before they see you, keep your wind right, I'll kind of hunt them. Once they get away from me or get to their bed and I don't know exactly where they're at, he's not continuing to bugle, like I'm just going to hold up and back out and stay on that bull and wait for him to come out in the evening. The best chance for me to kill a bull is the evening, coming out in the parks and then feeding in those parks in there. And I have an hour, and those thermals are starting to scream downhill. So now I don't have the wind that I have to worry about. I just approach from below. I've got a super strong wind that I can use, and then I kill them in the evening, a lot of them. But for those middle of the day, dude, I don't – they're active morning and night. What I do is I'll catch a nap in the middle of the day. I'll be sitting on elk. I'll use it to relocate. I am so focused on morning and evening. But the deal is, dude, it's like I use the night to locate elk as well. So it's – my hunts, they start in the afternoon or even middle of the day, hiking into an area if I'm not already in there. And then once I get in there, I'm going to hunt that evening really hard, but I am the last guy out of the woods. I'm hunting them till dark, and I'm walking out with a headlamp. And in the mornings, a lot of times I'm starting at 4 or 5 in the morning with my headlamp on to get to where they're at. And then I'll use the night too, and I'll camp in a location. That's like another hunt. So you have your morning, your evening, and your night. If you camp in a drainage where you can hear elk and you hear them at night bugling while you're around camp, now you're on elk in the morning. You have them located and locating them.
So you're moving from your even, let's say evening doesn't work out, you're even moving from that to another spot for your camp for that opportunity.
If I'm not on elk, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. I did not think
but I don't, a lot of guys say they do good middle of the day. For my tactics and the elk that I hunt, they are not active in the middle of the day. Every once in a while I'll get a heated up bull in the middle of the day, but I mean, I don't know. I maybe killed a bull that bedded that I saw him bed. If I see his exact bed, then I can make a play or a stalk on him. But more open terrain, like not like our mountain terrain that we're hunting a lot of times every once in a while. But, dude, for the most part, I just don't waste my energy. You just don't see elk. Perfect example is like, so I was hunting this place called the Middle of the Middle this year. And I called it the Middle of the Middle because it's the farthest place away from any accesses from all four directions. It's right in the middle of this zone, right? And so I was hunting these great bulls in there, and so I'd have to leave pretty early, or I'd have to sleep in there and camp in there or whatever. And so the one morning I get on this great bull, and you know, it's kind of this situation that I'm talking about where they're kind of feeding their way into the timber, and I make a play up on the ridge and try to make a go at them, not spooking anything, and they just get away from me and in the trees. And then he bugles till about 9 o'clock, and he's still bugling, but he's getting in the thick timber with all the sticks and crackling, and it's noisy and all those cows in there. And I'm just like, I got a better chance to kill him at night when he comes out in the park. So he just sat down and waited, and he stops bugling, you know, 8:45, 9 o'clock or whatever, and didn't bugle much as he went into the trees where I could really get a good locate on him. So I'm just going to sit on him, I'm going to wait, and I'm going to hunt him in the evening. Well, about that time, like I'm in the middle of the middle, I hear a bugle and a cow call behind me. I'm like, what the heck, you know? And it's like that same calling setup that you hear, and then another couple cow calls. I'm like, yeah, oh, that's a little fishy, you know? And so I walk over, and then I glass like three guys on the ridge. So they had hiked in here. So here I'm in the best drainage. I've heard 300 bugles that morning. They're going off. There's different bulls everywhere, but they're all put away. And by the time those guys left at daybreak to not get eaten by a grizzly, and by the time they got to the middle of the middle, they were standing over the best elk drainage right there. And they were bugling and cow calling. They didn't get an answer. It's mid-morning. They hiked out of there. They had no idea, you know. And then, like, I was on that bull all by myself in the evening. So it's a perfect example. Like, you just got to be in the right places at the right time, but I'm not a middle of the day hunter.
Okay. And so another question came up while you were saying that. So I've been winded from elk from like 850 yards out, and I was muzzleloader hunting, which talking about extending seasons even more. I hunted with a muzzleloader this year, and I had a swirl of wind that came with a strong gust. And I mean, the weather was really shifty, and I blew out a herd of bulls from 850 yards. How far are you backing out midday to really feel safe, but also be able to hear them without, say, a wind shift or something? Like, what is your range that you're trying to back up, or what are you doing to feel safe about staying on them and hearing them when they get back up and start moving, but not potentially blowing up that afternoon from a bad wind?
Yeah, it's a the mountain winds blow more stalks than anything else out there. And so it's like, you're like, if you really want to kill a bunch of elk and a bunch of mule deer, you master the winds. And so bear season makes you really good at it. And so what you do is you just learn how the thermals and the directionals move through the mountain ranges. You take notes on it, you know, and you can always get a swirling wind, but there's a reason it's swirling. Maybe you're on the backside of a ridge and the wind's blowing over. Maybe it's a bull that's catching it. And so
that
you,
was my problem with that, right? Or with that muzzleloader hunt, is that it was off the basin of this big mountain. The wind would hit it and swirl right around and pull it back. So I was trying to play it the best I could, but every direction I kept going, because I kept trying to circle way around him. I mean, I was like, oh, I'm 900 yards out. I should be fine with the swirling wind. No.
No. Well, no. And it's like, sometimes you're just going to lose the game, right? And I've been winded from 600 yards from the 12 different bulls and all the cows coming all up into a public drainage, and I have it all to myself, and I'm on the ridge and think I'm far enough. My wind blew over the top and blew up the whole thing. I never got a chance at them, and I hiked so many miles to get in there. It happens to all of us. But I think it's like getting a good understanding of them. So that situation that you're talking about there, I was like 300-400 yards back, but I had a good wind. Sun was hitting the hillside, started to go up. I knew I was fine. And eventually I felt like I couldn't see the hillside, like they were in that timber and they could have dropped down into this part. So I ended up circling all the way around to a different vantage point where then I could see down in there, knew my wind was still good. And sure enough, that night, they didn't come out in the park where I was waiting, but where I'd circled around, I was able to hear them or see them down in there and then move down in and go get on them down in there.
Okay, so you use that midday to regain another vantage on them.
Yep.
Okay,
yep,
wow.
I did. Good. Yep, and it's just getting this understanding of what those thermals and directionals are doing, you know, and then really playing that wind. So like I say, I love that evening because I know I've got that downhill thermal, you know, in the mountains. It's just so key. Like once those hillsides get shaded, that air starts to cool, it starts to drop, and it's just this steady downhill. I kill a lot of bulls with that wind, you know. I love that wind. And so I'm always trying to dial it in, and I make mistakes. I get winded too, but the whole reason I killed my bull this year was my ability to read wind, and it was fickle. Like I got in the draw and it was going up towards the bull on the side hill. It was coming left to right, you know, and so I just started reading all these winds and then positioning myself around those elk at daybreak, and then just hunted my way into them in the timber as they were working their way rutting, and then finally got a chance at that herd bull in there. But the whole reason I killed that bull was my ability to read thermals and directionals and have like this higher understanding of the wind. So take notes. Like, bear season's great. Like, if you ever get busted by a bear, like, he either wandered off or he smelled you. Yeah. You know, they can smell 300 times what a bloodhound can smell. You know, it's like, if any little wind swirls or anything, they just got you and they're gone. So bears make you, like, better at wind, which is better for elk.
And I'm typically very good with wind. Like, I pay super close attention to the thermals. And on that particular hunt I'm talking about, I was glassing them from daybreak. And, I mean, it was 5 miles in, glassing them from daybreak, like first break of day. And waited until noon to make a stalk because I was like, oh, I just need to let the thermal stabilize. And for some reason, I mean, I shouldn't have tried to cheat that swirling wind in there. I'd needed to either wait for them to move or do something different. But, yeah, I don't know. That was just a bad scenario, I guess. Dude, but
we all learn it. I have this drainage that's so full of elk every year. And I have this drainage, and I dive in there, and I try to hunt these elk, and I've done it way too many times. It isn't like one time learn your lesson and outsmart them. It's like I've dove down in there five times. There's always these giant bulls, and they're screaming, and they're rutting, and I go down in this bowl, and it's like the lee wind side, and the wind blows over the top, and it swirls in that basin. Mm-hmm. I've been winded 5 out of 5 times. Finally, the day I didn't go down after them, and I sat on the hillside, I'm like, I'm not going to do it. I just can't. I'm gonna wait till they get on that feature, and then I'll make a play. Sure enough, they started heading out, like that bull that's in the house that's on that far right side.
Yeah.
He's like a bull that came from over there, you know? And basically, he escaped out of that bull and went on the ridge line, and now he was on the dominant wind side, and I jumped in behind him and trailed him all the way to his bed, and then arrowed him in his bed, and he was just like this great big 6-point. It was like, finally, you know, it was like I was never going to beat the wind down in there. You know, I just learned my lesson. So there are areas where you just can't win.
Yeah. Some basins, the wind just swirls. When
that's
the
wind's where they're going,
there. It just swirls.
Yep. Yeah.
They're not, absolutely. Yeah, they're not dumb for a reason. They're smart critters. But yeah, I've hunted areas like that in Colorado where no matter what you do, if there's wind, it's swirling in there. And you'll see elk in there all day, and that's why they're in there. They're safe. But yeah, and then you'll see drainages that look just like it, or basins up high that, you know, if that wind picks up, you're not going to get a play on them. So you almost just got to hunt them, like you said, on the lee wind side, or even, I mean, north or south or whatever direction off the drainage. You just got to jump in on them when they get out of that.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's exactly it. Well, and imagine if you could take that variable away of the wind, like how many more animals you'd kill with all weapons, you know? And so as a bow hunter, like I realized that it's like, man, if you can, and it, you know, I don't know if you can ever master it. It's like you still get winded here and there, but that higher understanding of the wind and then creative thinking of like when they escape, like Tristan's talking, figuring out where to hunt them at on the escape routes or that, like really critical thinking or really problem solving, you know, that creative thinking is rewarded in the woods. So they're like, the more you can come up with that, or I heard you mention, Paul, like theorizing, like this is all bro science. There's no literature anywhere about what we're talking. This is just all experience and what we've figured out on our own. So it's all just these theories, you know? And so you got to come up with these theories. And then I heard you also say, prove them right. Like you come up with a theory and then sometimes you follow that and go, well, I was wrong on that one. Yeah, there really are no elk there. You know,
I hear people in the science field always, they say, prove your theories wrong.
Yeah. Yeah,
attempt
that's
to prove it wrong.
Yeah, but you come up with these theories of where what you think these elk are doing, where you think these elk are at, and then you go try to prove it in there. But yeah, it's rewarded in the mountains for sure, man.
Yeah,
we're going to put it to the test this bear season. We got tags here in Montana and Idaho, so we're going to do the two states this year.
Good for you guys.
Which will be the first time out of state for bear, so
yeah.
It's going to be a cool hunt, and we're doing a lot of e-scouting, which – like you said, that western side of Montana, we've never been. So that stuff in Idaho over there, completely new to both of us. Mm-hmm. So trying to, like you said, think about the differences that they're going to potentially be on more of these south faces, because these north faces, they don't have any feed. Mm-hmm. They don't have any potential. So just trying to find the differences, and then, it's going to be interesting and another learning experience, but just adding that to the bank, I guess.
Yeah, good for you guys.
We'll piece it together.
Yep. Yeah. I think that's the key to my success is that I just hunt a bunch. I'm in the mountains a bunch. It just educates you. Like even if you're dumbass, you're sure to pick up a few things, you know, along the way, or they teach you like a few good lessons along the way, you know. But yeah, if you really care about it or you love it and you spend time doing it, you just get better at it, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is.
And I'm just too stubborn to quit. I think that's the only reason I've even found any success at all. I don't think I'm that talented. I just, I get my butt kicked and my head bashed in all season long, and eventually it works out.
But. It's all of us, man. Persistence is deadly. You just got to keep after it, you know, and you fail and you fail and you fail. It's like the prerequisite to being successful. You know, you screw things up and you'd like, sometimes you just feel like the biggest idiot in the world. It was like, ah, how did I not know that wind was doing that? Or how did I miss that shot? God, I'm such an idiot. But you pick yourself back up, you learn from it, you get better. And then, you know, eventually you get another opportunity. But yeah, no, it's, you guys are on an amazing path. It was like, man, you guys will be far better than I am by the time you get to my age, because you guys just have so much experience in spending so much time in the mountains and your guys' passion for it. So it's like no surprise to your success already, and you're only going to see more success. Like, I can't wait to see what you guys turn up this season and seasons in the future.
Well, the resources available.
Yeah.
I mean, your podcast, I've listened to your podcast a lot, and a lot of the Spring Bear tactics that I've started, and I've developed my own now. But just starting to understand and the amount of resources out there, that was a huge part. I mean, I didn't see I couldn't even find a cow that entire first season. Mm-hmm. And just continuing to learn and listen and take up as much information, which is readily accessible now. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible time to learn, and I feel like that is the only reason that we are where we are.
Yeah,
it's not that we're any tougher than you were at our age. I'm sure you're even tougher because your gear wasn't as good. Bad gear, like you said, makes you have to be tougher.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like listening to your podcast or other people's podcasts, they shorten that learning curve that everyone talks about, and it does. But I think shortening that learning curve will put you on animals. And the more experience you have with animals, the better you get. So that helped us from beating around the woods and not finding anything. We'd listen to podcasts like yours and we'd go find stuff, and that would present us opportunities and we'd get better from that. So I think it helped us shorten our learning curve by quite a bit and a lot faster. So,
well, and you have to want it too. It's like the information is out there. Like, you're right. It's the information day and age, but it's never been tougher out there in the mountains. There's a lot of guys that have that information that are going really hard. So you have to find ways to separate yourself. And I also think you have to, like, that information is out there, like, you know, through podcasts, and you gain tidbits. But it's almost like it's useless if you don't go apply it. Like, you can have all the information in the world, but you just can't call it from the couch, you know? It's like you've got to take that information, and then you've got to apply it to your own hunting, where it's applicable, you know, like where you can fit it in. It's like, oh, I've heard somebody talk about, or I've heard him talk about these slopes and this deal at this time of year. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a bear. Oh, yeah. Okay, I see it now. You know, it makes sense to me. But you really have to, like, take that information, and then you have to want it. You have to go apply it to your own hunting and get your own experiences and learn from those encounters. Like, yeah, I just – but I do think that it is a great learning tool. You just have to apply it to your own hunting.
I think, too, in the moment of truth, no matter how many podcasts you heard, like – that all goes out the window. You don't think about that. It's it's what you know. What you know at that point. Totally. So, yeah, I think it goes hand in hand with what you're just talking about.
Totally.
Yeah.
And what you said, same thing with gear. Just because you have the best gear doesn't mean you're going to be out there doing it. You have to be out there doing it. You have to want it. And I want this so bad. Like, I hate not being successful. I hate not having a great experience. That, like, I just want to do everything possible in every other season and in that season to make that happen.
Yeah, well, you're doing it. Yeah, you guys are doing all the right things. Really impressed. So, yeah, we got to get you back on here and hear about your bear season. I'm sure you guys will have some wild adventures out there. But, yeah, just keep after it, man. You guys are doing all the right things. Yep, keep living life and having passion for it. That's what, like, really makes for a fulfilling life, too, is, like, having something that you really love to do, putting everything into it, and then just seeing where the chips fall, you know? And It's like we enjoy being successful, but really it's like the journey of being able to have all these wild adventures and wild encounters out in nature, man. It's like so cool that we found our love for things. But yeah, you guys are doing it. Just keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We tell each other all the time. We're like, man, can you imagine where we would be without the passion of hunting? Like, what would life be like? Like, can you imagine not having something that you're this passionate about?
be a golfer.
Yeah.
I don't know. Exactly. They're pretty passionate, though. A lot of those guys, they take that seriously.
Yeah, yeah. They do. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I think we're both passionate and competitive, so that helps out quite a bit.
Yeah. Competitions are...
We'll have competitions and lose by a quarter inch and not be happy about it for the rest of the day, but that makes you better, mm-hmm. you know?
Who won tonight? We had a win-all, take-all in the end. I think Paul got it.
I mean, if you're counting that giveaway at the end, I took it, but I mean, you had us there.
Yeah, no, I don't know about that. No, I think you actually won it in the end. I think mine was my fourth arrow. It's that broadhead I shot. So yeah. I think you were closest to target. But yeah, no, really good shooting. I was really impressed with you guys shooting today.
Yeah, and thanks for having us over. That was a ton of fun.
Yeah, let's do it a bunch this summer. So competition's good for a guy, right? And that pressure, that high-pressure shooting.
Yeah.
I think that transitions to shooting at animals as well.
Good. So, yeah.
Yeah, we got to get over to the 3D range too. I don't know if you want to get out there with us, but we have over there and it's really affordable. A lot of good targets, tough sets, and some longer ranges out to 90 and even 100. You can stretch it out. And
oh, yeah. That one out in Sheridan?
Yeah.
They do a great job. They have that thing set up really good. What's it cost per time through that?
$40 for a year membership or $10 a day.
Okay, cool.
But, yeah. I mean, we get out there 15, 20 times a summer. I mean, we're out there 3-4 days a week shooting.
Good for you guys. If you guys don't get carried away by the mosquitoes out there?
We have.
It might be 80 degrees and we've got long sleeves on or a rain jacket.
They're pretty evil out there, aren't they? I don't know if it's just a swamp or summertime or what, but, yeah, they're pretty thick out there. But it's a great course. Those guys do a great job. And, yeah, I just want to support them as much as I can as far as financial, so they can replace targets mm-hmm. and so they, you know, they spend the time mowing and then setting them up. But yeah,
oh, they've conned us into mowing and helping and doing good everything. Old dog over there is hilarious.
Yeah. Oh, good for you guys.
Yeah, we try to give him a help or give him a hand as much as we can. But yeah, right on. Great range, and we'll have to head over there at some point.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, keep after it, guys.
Yeah. No, all right. Thanks for having us,
Talk soon.